The world's largest tropical rainforest, the Amazon, may be experiencing some fundamental changes in its weather. That's what a team of scientists concluded this week after studying what's been happening to Amazonian trees over the past 30 years. NPR's Christopher Joyce has more.
The Amazon is well known as home to more different kinds of animals and plants than anywhere else. But climate scientists see the forest for its trees, because plants soak up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as they grow. And the Amazon has a big appetite for this global warming gas. In fact, the Amazon rainforest consumes about one-fifth of what people all over the planet put up into the atmosphere from burning coal and oil and natural gas. But there's a flip side. When plants die and decompose, the rainforest returns a lot of that carbon to the atmosphere. On average, though, the forest helps reduce CO2 in the atmosphere. It takes up more than it emits. Overall, it's been a carbon sink. That is until 2005, when a major drought hit parts of the Amazon. Ecologist Oliver Phillips was there to see the first signs of change. Phillips, from the University of Leeds in England, was part of a large group of scientists who trekked through the Amazon during and after the drought.
There was a little slowing in growth, but a bigger kick in terms of killing trees.
They found that trees grew more slowly from lack of water, and they took up less carbon. And because they were dying at a faster than normal rate, they were putting tons more carbon back into the air than normal.
So instead of being a sink of about, say, 400 to 500 million tons, the system became a source of somewhere close to 1 billion tons in that year.
They'd never seen that happen before in the Amazon. The scientists wrote up their results in the current issue of the journal Science. Now, droughts are not very common in the Amazon's tropical rainforests. Some scientists, such as forest ecologist Dan Nepstad with the Moore Foundation, suspect that changes in the Atlantic Ocean may be what's affecting the weather in the Amazon.
Global warming may already be having an influence in the Amazon. By changing the sea surface temperature, the warming of the northern tropical Atlantic in 2005 may have been more intense because of global warming. Some climatologists think so.
2005 was also the year that unusually warm sea surface temperatures in the Atlantic spawned Hurricane Katrina. Nepstad says the Amazon could become part of a giant feedback loop, getting drier from climate change and then emitting more carbon into the atmosphere and making the world's climate even warmer. Some scientists have even predicted that the Amazon could become a savanna by the end of the century. This scientific team doesn't go that far. Phillips says they aren't sure whether the 2005 drought is in fact a single incident or something that could happen more often. But computer models of climate change do predict that a warmer climate could make the southern Amazon drier. How much and when is still unknown. Phillips says at the very least, their study of the 2005 drought gives them a better idea of what might happen.
I think the interesting thing about what we've done is not so much documenting just what happened in 2005, but saying here's the sensitivity of the forest to, if you like, a climate shock. So if a drought like 2005 was repeated in the future, we now have a better handle on what's likely to happen.
What could happen is that the forest becomes part of the problem of global warming rather than a solution. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Next, we'll meet a man who's in charge of trying to get an international deal on climate change. He's in Washington, D.C. this week trying to stir up support for a new global warming treaty. He works for the UN. He's finding friendly new faces in the Obama administration, but huge issues need to be resolved between now and December when the treaty is supposed to be negotiated in Copenhagen. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Ivo de Boer has a clumsy title, Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. At the moment, his job is really more like cheerleader-in-chief, or you could call him the Flying Dutchman as he travels the world trying to forge a climate deal that would replace the current ineffective climate treaty which was negotiated in Kyoto.
About the only thing that I'm absolutely sure of is that 2009 will go down in history as the year of climate change. Either because we failed to seek what I really see as a unique opportunity, or because we took a decision to ride a wave of change.
Success won't come easy. De Boer says he has to get the United States to commit to deep and meaningful cuts in its carbon dioxide emissions. He has to convince developing countries like China and India to step up too. And last but not least, in the face of a global economic crisis, he has to convince rich nations of the world to come up with large amounts of cash to help poor nations cope with climate change.
That is the weakest link in the chain, and it's very much at the heart of the discussions that I'm having here.
He's pushing back against the notion that it's too much to cope with the financial crisis and the climate crisis simultaneously. And he's getting help from, among other people, Connie Hedegaard, Denmark's Minister for Climate and Energy. At a Brookings Institution event where the two appeared on Wednesday, Hedegaard argued this is precisely the time to push forward.
Not only because we need to tackle climate change, but also because how often are we provided with an opportunity to rethink business as usual?
Mr. Obama is trying to address climate change and the economy at the same time by stimulating green jobs, she noted. But that's not enough. In order to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, dirty energy will simply have to cost more. And Carlos Pascual from the Brookings Institution says that won't be an easy or quick sale on Capitol Hill.
I am absolutely confident that we are eventually going to get to a new regime on climate change. I don't know if we're going to get there by Copenhagen.
Pascual said the worst-case scenario is that the U.S. goes to the talks in Copenhagen 9 months from now and is simply not ready to agree on a deal, despite all the international pressure. That could stop momentum for a climate treaty in its tracks.
Second-case scenario is that we have a rerun of Kyoto. We go to Copenhagen, and the United States makes all sorts of commitments on national emission targets. We come back here, and we can't pass them through the Senate.
And the Senate needs to ratify a treaty with 67 votes, which is even harder than getting 60 votes for domestic climate legislation. So he argues we need a fallback plan for Copenhagen in case the U.S. is not ready to sign a new climate treaty by the December deadline. Ivo de Boer, the Flying Dutchman, was having none of it.
You can't go to Copenhagen and mumble. There has to be a clear commitment to emission reduction targets on the part of industrialized countries.
De Boer's challenge is to create that consensus in the next 9 months, and the Obama administration isn't quite ready to go. As De Boer walks the Washington corridors looking for people to cajole, he says he still sees a lot of empty offices. Richard Harris, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Here is one of the ways that President Obama's budget attempts to do more than just make the numbers add up. There's a plan in that budget to pair up two important issues for the new president, tax cuts and global warming. The budget would increase the price of dirty energy and use some of that new revenue to fund a middle-class tax cut. NPR's Richard Harris looks at how it could play out.
To slow the pace of climate change, we would need to ratchet back the amount of carbon dioxide that pours into the atmosphere through tailpipes, chimneys, and smokestacks. One way to do this is a scheme called cap and trade. The government sets a cap or a limit on the amount of carbon dioxide that can be emitted, and the government then sells permits that give companies the right to pollute. David Victor at the Stanford Law School says one consequence of this is dirty energy gets more expensive.
That's the whole idea behind a market scheme, is you make carbon more expensive, and that forces people to find new ways to use less of it and to switch to new technologies and to change their behavior.
In the case of the proposed federal budget, each year, starting in 2012, the government would auction off $80 billion worth of carbon emission permits. That would effectively raise the price of energy by about $80 billion a year. Last week, House GOP leader John Boehner of Ohio said he has real problems with this idea.
Let's just be honest and call it a carbon tax that will increase taxes on all Americans who drive a car, who have a job, who turn on a light switch, pure and simple.
About 80% of that money would flow right back to Americans in the form of the much-touted tax cut for people earning less than $250,000 a year. But under the budget proposal, about 20% of the revenue would not come back to taxpayers. It would fund research into cleaner energy. So this is shaping up to be a bit of a test for President Obama. Can he convince the American public to pay more for energy to take on global warming, as long as they get a tax cut in the process? Advocates like Eileen Clausen at the Pew Center for Global Climate Change hope the answer is yes.
The notion we should have a cap and trade and we should have it soon is, of course, something we've been working for 10 years.
But Clausen doubts that the proposal will fly in its current form. That's because taxpayers aren't the only ones who will want some of the money. So will companies like coal-burning utilities, which will be hard hit if they have to pay to emit carbon dioxide.
There's got to be a transition. You can't do it overnight. And I think it's those companies that you want to invest in the technologies of the future.
Many of those fossil fuel businesses have tremendous clout on Capitol Hill and aren't about to sit idly by. Last summer, when the Senate debated a cap-and-trade proposal, lawmakers ended up making deals with those companies and promised them a cut of the revenue from the cap-and-trade bills they were writing.
One of the bills that was being considered in the Senate envisioned trillions of dollars of revenue that would be reallocated to various purposes.
And David Victor from Stanford says even then, the bills fell far short of passage. This time around, the Obama administration isn't offering industry any of that money. It's mostly designated for the middle-class tax cut. So Victor says the budget proposal, as it stands, isn't crafted to satisfy the real politics of Capitol Hill.
This budget should be viewed as the opening bid in a very complicated negotiation, not only about the broader federal budget, but also about what we're going to do about global warming. I don't think we're anywhere near closure on this issue. It could take a long time.
And it's not clear whether hitching together tax cuts and climate change will help both issues succeed or put them both in political jeopardy. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Another energy experiment involves a kind of alternative to coal, at least a partial alternative. Lindt Chocolate is teaming up with a power plant in New Hampshire to produce electricity. They ran a test trial yesterday. Their recipe called for one part cocoa bean shells, 33 parts coal. Mix them up, set them on fire. It's believed to be the only chocolate cocoa bean energy project in the country. How could it be the only chocolate cocoa bean energy project in the country? I thought everybody was into this. In any event, it's still too soon to see how successful the idea will be. Lindt will begin sending its shells to the power plant once it starts producing its own chocolate from raw cocoa later this year.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. If you drive east of Los Angeles toward Las Vegas, and then you turn off on Highway 395 towards the Sierras, before long you'll pass a little crossroads in the high desert called Kramer Junction. There isn't much to see there. A few gas stations, a railroad crossing, an old drive-up burger shack. But just a few miles north of that tiny town, look to your left, and you'll see thousands of gleaming curved mirrors aimed at the sun. Together with several nearby fields of mirrors, it's the world's largest commercial solar energy installation. And it was built in the 1980s. For the last two decades, lots of alternative energy projects have been stuck in the mud, but solar appears to be on the rise again. This month, the folks at Bright Source Energy, including some engineers from that solar project in the 1980s, struck a deal with the utility company Southern California Edison to supply over a gigawatt, that's 1,000 megawatts, over 1,000 megawatts of solar generating power in the Mojave Desert. That's a lot of power comparable to what you'd get from a nuclear reactor. But how can they build it so big? What's the technology? And really, what took them so long? We'll start this hour by talking about the road ahead for solar in California, which is usually a trendsetter for the rest of the country. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. Or if you're on Twitter, you can tweet your questions to us by writing the at sign, followed by SciFry. And in Second Life, you can join us on Science Friday Island and get a free T-shirt and talk with the other avatars there. Let me introduce my guest. John Woolard is the CEO of Bright Source Energy based in Oakland. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Can you explain how your technology works? Is it based on mirrors also?
Our technology is based on mirrors. And as you mentioned, we have a lot of the engineers that worked on those older plants in California in the 1980s. And what we do is we just take lots of small flat mirrors. We focus the sun's light up onto what we call a boiler. And the boiler is very similar to the boiler inside of a fossil fuel power plant. That boiler generates superheated steam that then turns a turbine, and that turbine produces electricity that goes to the grid.
Mm-hmm. And conveniently, I guess necessarily, you can look on Google Earth and see the spot right there in the desert. It looks like there are power lines that run right through there.
Yes, there are. So when we look at any site for these power plants, we're building quite a few plants between Pacific Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison. We look for sites that are already disturbed, that are flat and boring, frankly. We look for flat, boring, disturbed, and also with ideally transmission lines already very close to the site so that we can deliver the power to the grid and ultimately to consumers.
And how soon will you start churning out electricity from this new venture?
Well, we've been doing the engineering for many years, and we've built a facility in Israel. Our engineering team's actually based overseas in Israel that now delivers what we call it's about 6 megawatts of power of steam power. We will be building our California plant starting at the end of this year, and ultimately it takes about 2 years to construct one of these large power plants. So they'll start to deliver power to the grid by 2011, 2012.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was talk just a few months ago through the papers, through the financial sections of the Internet, that said that alternative fuels, big projects like solar power, even wind power, were dead in the water due to the lack of capital now due to the banks and the Wall Street situation. Has that all been turned around now with the stimulus package?
Well, actually, the administration and Senate and Congress did one thing very, very well in the stimulus bill, which is they thought through how to bridge renewable energy projects from a challenging financial market into a future where you can actually construct plants. And they did a good job through loan guarantee programs where the taxpayer isn't taking too much risk but is making sure that banks can come in and loan money into these projects, and also solving another smaller challenge, which was called tax equity, because as the Wall Street investors were losing their taxable income, they were losing their appetite to invest in some of these projects. So I think the administration and Senate and Congress, Reid in particular, did a fantastic job of thinking through how to bridge from challenging financial markets and allow these renewable projects, wind, solar, all large renewables, to move forward.
And how will they compare with a gigawatt, let's say, of your solar with a gigawatt of natural gas or other energy, price-wise?
Price-wise, we try to stay as competitive as possible with natural gas. So if you look at the way natural gas is produced, natural gas has peaking plants that produce the power in the middle of the day. And those plants are generally higher cost and higher price than a plant that can operate 24 hours a day. But peak power is what's really needed, and that's where solar fits in very nicely. Solar is produced generally, your peak demand is when the sun is shining, air conditioner loads are higher, people are still at work. And so these plants have a nice coincidence with peak and are very competitive with peak pricing.
There are some people who've wondered about whether you're going to be dampening the smaller solar efforts. Being a big company that puts out so many gigawatts, what about the smaller local solar producers and people putting solar power on their roofs, things like that? How do you answer that criticism?
Oh, I think that the small solar power is absolutely critical to our future. So you'll see a continued growth in photovoltaics for many years, and I think that's really important. So I don't view this as an either or. If you look at how much clean power needs to get delivered for the next 15 to 20 years, it's a huge amount. We did 400 megawatts of photovoltaics last year. We need to be doing gigawatts of solar power. So I think you're going to need lots of distributed photovoltaics, and you're going to need to be able to produce lower cost central solar as well to bring this scale, to address the problem at scale.
How much of, theoretically, how much of the Mojave could you use to produce a larger amount of California's power?
Oh, a very small amount. I think the numbers are somewhere around 1 or 2% of the Mojave would power all of California. So it's and I think less than a tenth of a percent of the land in the U.S. could power the entire country. So it's very efficient on its use of land, and we try to look at land that's always very flat and boring, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Let me see if I can get a phone call in here. Aaron in Detroit. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for getting me on the air here. Long-time listener. Love your show. I actually represent, well, I'm with one of the manufacturing companies that's been experiencing, you know, downturn from the automotive. And we're trying to get more into the solar manufacturing and whatnot. But I guess I kind of have maybe a two-part question. One would be, with the systems that you're building, are there going to be a lot of opportunities for manufacturers to kind of jump into the supply chain and start producing? And the second would be along the lines of storage, with power instead of transmitting it, which seems to be a large problem, where's the technology as far as batteries go to store, make this more available for everybody?
Oh, yeah, he's got a bad line there. I'm sorry we had to cut him off. But you got the question?
I did. And let me address the manufacturing piece first and then storage second. If you look at what it takes to bring manufacturing online, we have quite a few components. We have mirrors, and those can be sourced either domestically or internationally. We always prefer to do anything we can domestically. We have gears. We have steel fabrication, steel post, boilers that sit on tops of these towers. So there's quite a bit of, and it's always easier to, anything you can do domestically, you don't have to ship, you don't have to transport. So we're focused on doing everything we can on what I would say is domestic manufactured components. The other part of the question was around storage, and I believe the caller was talking about electrical storage.
Yes.
But what's interesting about solar thermal power is you can also store thermally. So, and thermal storage is about a third the cost of electrical storage. But they're not mutually exclusive. So you can store power at a thermal plant like this. You can then move some power to the shoulders of the day. But ultimately, as you, if we do move to a world with more things like plug-in hybrids or electric cars, those can take advantage of storing as well. And the more storage we have on the grid, the better off we all are, because it's a big, it provides some buffering and the ability for renewables and other resources to come online.
Do you have to pass any more regulatory hurdles or environmental impact statements, things like that?
We're in the process of going through a broad permitting process. So we go through the National Environmental Policy Act environmental review, as well as the California Environmental Quality Act review, and we've done a lot of thorough work on that, and should be through both of those processes by mid to late this year.
What other states might take up your lead here?
Well, California's so far been leading from a procurement perspective, but we can put these sites in any areas that are sunny. We have sites in Nevada. We have sites in Arizona. We have some in New Mexico. And we also have interested utilities and off-takers in those other states as well. But we're very focused on the sunniest areas in the Southwest.
But that would not eliminate some places back east or in the South, where there might be sunnier.
No, that generally what you will do is any place where you need solar thermal, you want to locate in an area with direct sunlight. So that's the sweet spot is the southwestern U.S. You can then transport your power to Washington State, Oregon, Midwest.
Do the lines exist for that, the grid work?
The lines do exist, and it's a matter of getting transmission capacity, but there will be transmission challenges over time. So if you want to bring large amounts of renewables on, we need to continue to upgrade the transmission infrastructure.
And is there money for that in the stimulus package, I imagine?
There is some money for grid in the stimulus package or some funds allocated. It's for increasing transmission, and I think you'll find that a very big focus of the energy bill that they're thinking through this summer is how to bring on more transmission to allow more renewable or nuclear or any decarbonized power to come online.
John Willard, thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
All right. Thank you, Ira.
Good luck to you. John Willard is the CEO of Bright Source Energy that's based in Oakland, and they are installing over gigawatts of solar thermal power. Get the contracts for that to do that in California. We're going to take a break and come back and change gears and talk about the international – well, this is the International Year of Science, and we're going to talk about astronomy and the Hubble and all kinds of stuff. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, some news you can use the next time you have to release a crocodile in the wild in the hopes that it won't come back to where you found it. It's not an everyday problem for most of us, but in Florida, sometimes a crocodile crawls into someone's yard, and sometimes the croc is placed back in the wild. The crocs are evidently a very gifted species when it comes to getting right back to that same yard after they've been taken away. So here is the latest experimental tool to keep them from doing that. Magnets. Lindsay Horde, biologist with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, joins us from his office in Okeechobee, Florida. Lindsay Horde, what do you do with magnets?
We're attempting to disorient the crocodile's navigational senses and prevent it from returning to its capture site by placing magnets on a crocodile's head while it's in transit from its capture site to its release site. Of course, then we remove the magnets at its release site, and the hope is that at this point it doesn't know where it's at. So if it doesn't know where it's at, it can't return to where it came from.
This is safer than blindfolding the croc and spinning him around many times. You're trying to confuse the crocodile's navigational system here.
Basically, yes.
Yeah. How many times have you tried it?
We've tried it just twice. Some scientists in Mexico dealing with the same species, the American crocodile, tested it for a couple of years and had reported some fairly good success. We saw the article and, of course, said, well, we might as well try this. We're already relocating crocodiles, so it can't hurt. Let's see if this works for us.
And still too early to find out whether those two crocs have...
Way too early.
Yep. Why, in theory, would the magnets block the crocodile's sense of direction or location? Do we assume that their whole system of navigation is magnetic?
Well, there's some evidence that they sense the Earth's magnetic field in some way to orient themselves. There's some evidence that they use celestial navigation. They probably use visual cues when they're close to something. They may even use olfactory stimulus to return to their house. It just depends on, the distance that you're talking about. Certainly for over long distances, they're going to have to use something that basically is like a GPS, that it says, okay, you were here, you're here now, here's how you get back to where you were.
Now, we say place magnets on the crocodile's head. It sounds a lot easier said than done. It sounds rather dangerous putting little magnets on the crocodile.
It's really not. Of course, we're having to capture these crocodiles anyway, in these situations. So once we capture the crocodile and it is secured, then we're basically just taping these magnets to the crocodile's head. It looks like and seems like it's dangerous, but in reality, if we're doing the things properly, it's not that dangerous.
Okay, I'll take your word for that. Well, just before I let you go, we should note that the problem for people in Florida that crocodiles turn up on their property is evidence in part of a solution for the crocodiles, that you've actually been able to bring back the crocodile population in Florida over the years.
Yes, the American crocodile population in Florida is really an endangered species success story. However, the result of that recovery is that crocodiles are now being encountered in places where they haven't been seen for several decades, and those areas are places where people live. And, our job is to try to balance the needs of a recovering species along with public safety. So, we obviously try to get people to coexist with these crocodiles as much as possible.
Mr. Horde, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Today. That's Lindsay Horde, who is a biologist with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. He joined us from Okeechobee, Florida.